weren't here Wednesday, but I mentioned in the press file that I read over Psalm 22 several times. I think I've been reading it just about every day and started to commit part of it to memory. Because I want to be ready to give an answer when somebody, maybe not purposely, but maligns the character of Christ, saying that he was unstable, fluctuating. Because I see Jesus as perfect. He had a perfect answer, a perfect response in every situation.
Mm-hmm.
And he was with his wits. He understood what he was saying. He understood what he was doing. And he responded better than anybody else could have under the conditions that he was under as he's being tortured to death.
Mm-hmm.
And what we see is a surrender to the Father and thinking of others, thinking of his mother, thinking of the people around him that needed him, granting eternal salvation to the man that just ridiculed him, and forgiving the people around him. That's not an unstable person, but that's a person that is very much in control and a very strong person.
Amen to all that. Yes.
It also makes me wonder how much more there is in the writings and teachings of Jesus that I don't understand because I'm not Jewish and I'm not immersed in Jewish culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the people who were listening, they would have picked up on that.
Mm-hmm.
I've read that many times and I was thinking, well, Jesus was saying that because God was turning his back on him.
Right.
The sky was turning dark. And so it's as if God abandoned him, but not at all. And that's kind of, I'll just add a little thing.
Yes.
I don't want to take away from what you're
doing. Oh, no, no. You're right on track here.
I've incorporated that into my own teaching where I will say things in class, but I won't explain everything to my students.
Mm-hmm.
So that those who care, those who are questioning, will pick it up and it will cause them to question more. If they care enough, they'll ask me.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least I can watch their facial expression and then use that as a stepping stone to further talk to them.
Yes.
But for those who don't care, it doesn't matter so much talking to them because it's just blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And they'll forget about it. But I'm interested in those that are willing to engage me, even if they disagree with me.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a step. I've got a platform with them that they're thinking about it. And I'd rather somebody engage me, not agreeing with me, but listening to me, than somebody's just letting it go over their head and they don't care.
Yes. Indeed. Well, it's amazing how we can appropriate things when we have a preconceived notion. So whenever a given model is supplied to us, we don't typically just automatically question things, certainly not as children, and we make it work. But sometimes later in our life, we go back and look and say, okay, so where did this come from exactly? Is this truly the picture that is presented? And sometimes it kind of shakes our world a little. But a couple things just in connection with last week. Hopefully most things are connected here to last week. But I mentioned that one of the things that really in my mind repudiates the notion that Jesus went on to hell and suffered the torments of the judgment of God was, as I mentioned, on the cross he said, "It is finished." There didn't seem to be any anticipation of that. But on the way home, my wife mentioned to me, well, what about when he said to the thief, "This day thou shalt be with me in paradise"? Well, there's another one that doesn't quite match up with him headed for the judgments of God, does it? Yeah, sometimes we forget all the pieces and the bits of information we have and subjugate them actually to the model or the paradigm that we've accepted on a large scale. Welcome, Pastor.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yes, Keith, as a parent, sometimes you hear your children express something and like, how did you get that idea? We've never said that. But they've taken ideas and in their mind they heard and shaped it. I'm sure the apostles, if they heard the doctrines that get pulled out of their writings, would say, "I never said that." But we start forming and we plug it into a spot that we have in our head that it was not meant to go in, and we build on it a little bit, and yeah.
And they can always safely say, I never said that, because they weren't speaking in English, right? It's come a long ways since they said it. Anyway, we want to welcome everybody here this morning, and indeed, it's good to have Josiah and Sister Dorothy with us remotely. Sorry for the underlying causes of their presence, that is illness, but nevertheless, it is to our benefit. Okay, so I want to go through the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, verses of this, bless you, of this chapter. First of all, with just a mind to notice the fundamental ideas that are presented and to try to understand how they are related to one another. That is to say, whenever Isaiah brings these ideas up, what is the interrelationship of them? So kind of an overall view of meaning. And what we'll find here, because one of the ways we're going to examine this is to look at different translations of it, we'll find that, in fact, there apparently is a bit of a challenge in connecting these different ideas into a sentence. And so there are different translations, but we'll try to sort of get a handle on where it seems to be leading. So in verse 8, we have this in the King James, and he was taken from prison and from judgment, and who shall declare his generation? For he was cut off out of the land of the living, for the transgression of my people was he stricken. So when I talk about different concepts and how they're connected, start with, we have this picture of prison and judgment. Okay, and so in the King James, it suggests he was taken from this. Okay, and in our mind that means, oh, you go down here to the jail and you take somebody out of jail, right? That's kind of what's communicated. And so we look at some other translations. Is that the same idea that everybody is getting from this? Who shall declare his generation? I'm not sure what that means in English. If I just had to take that by itself, it would sound like his peers, his group, people in his age group, weren't talked about or something. You know, that might be what I think. So let's look at where that idea, how it enters some of the other translations. Cut off out of the land of the living. Now, that's pretty clear. He died. There's death involved here. For the transgression of my people was he stricken. Okay, so there is the idea of being hit, being stricken, and the idea of it being for the transgression of my people. Okay, so we'll pop over here to the other page. Sometime or another, I had looked at the JPS, and so now it's consistently showing up. But I'm going to start here with ESV. By oppression and judgment, he was taken away. Okay, so that's a totally different mindset, right? It's by these things that this happened, as opposed from. So let's see how that plays out in some of the other translations. In other words, do other people understand it in that way? The Septuagint on this we'll come back to, because it's often very different in Isaiah 53. The New American Standard says, by oppression and judgment he was taken away. Okay, so that's the same thing as ESV. The Complete Jewish Bible, after forcible arrest and sentencing. Okay, so that would be more in the sense of by instead of from. And NIV, by oppression and judgment. So it seems pretty clear in the minds of many, many learned folks that the sense of that first phrase is that it's talking about the fact that the fate that he suffered was not injustice. It was out of oppression. It was through judgment. And so that I think is the flavor of that predominates in the minds of translators. Okay, what about the generation thing? ESV says, "And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people?" Okay, so that's a totally different thought than we see in the King James. We're not quite sure what we see in the King James, right? But that is a complete thought, that it was, it's asking the question, in looking at his life and looking at his death and looking at his judgment and all these things, who happened to think that, well, it's our fault, it's because of us, it is as a result of our transgression that this is happening? So it's the whole section is considered as a question. In the ESV. NAS says, "And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due?" Okay, so essentially the same thing, slightly different wording. Complete Jewish says, "And none of his generation protested his being cut off." So what you see here is these guys working with these different elements of meaning. So declaring, protests, okay, so that's how it comes out here in the Complete Jewish Bible. And so considered versus protested. So I'm not sure what kind of argument there is to go one way or the other. In either case, it is still the central idea that his peers weren't particularly troubled, or there was no protest. They didn't even think about the fact that it was on their account that he was doing it. So it's in the same level of thinking, I think, that these other translations are. So none of his generation protested his being cut off from the land of the living for the crimes of my people, who deserve the punishment themselves. And then NIV goes with protested as well. Yet who of his generation protested? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people was he punished. So they don't make that last part of the verse part of the question. It's just they make it a separate statement. And I'm thinking that probably the Hebrew is unclear enough that these are all possibilities. I don't have that background in language to be able to even have an opinion about it. But the fact that so many different flavors come out of this from people who spend their whole lives dedicated to understanding this language tells me that it probably isn't totally clear. And you know, that's one thing we often don't realize when we read the Bible, is that it may not be as simple as it seems. And that's why it's so important that we don't go to seed on a really small thing, a really small part. You need to look at a bigger picture so that you reduce the likelihood of having errors in your understanding. So the big takeaway from this then is Isaiah prophesies that this suffering servant will suffer oppression and judgment, that he will die. He is cut off out of the land of the living. And in terms of the development of ideas, that really hasn't come up yet. He suffers, he's stricken, he bears, but now it's cut off out of the land of the living. So that's a new level of suffering that we've come into in this prophecy. But once again, there is the proclamation that it is on account of not his own sin, not on account of his own shortcoming, but on account of the transgression of others that he's suffering this. Okay, any questions about that verse and on with regard to this kind of approach? And you see what we're doing there in getting a bigger, a deeper understanding of the sense of it by looking at other translations. Okay, the next verse is verse 9. And here we have, "And he made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, because he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth." Okay, now in the King James, that's very puzzling. He made his grave with the wicked and the rich. Okay, now we understand from the actual history of Christ and his crucifixion that, yes, he was crucified with the wicked, and it was a rich man's grave that he was buried in. But the wording here is a little puzzling, and in particular, combined with the because he had done no violence, well, it looks like if you had done no violence, you wouldn't be making your grave with the wicked. So let's look at some other translations to see what comes out of that in other people's minds. We'll go ahead and do the JPS. I don't think against it. It's the Jewish Publication Society. And they made his grave with the wicked and with the rich in his tomb. Now, this is one thing that puzzles me about Hebrew, is how could two people read the same verse and one of them say he and one of them say they? I mean, this was before the day of confused pronouns. And so it's not about that. But, you know, apparently there is something about the language which sometimes you don't know whether the verb is plural or singular. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how that it could be so different.
I think there's something in Chinese like that, because I know Gino Zimkowitz would often get a wrong pronoun.
Okay.
And I've heard that.
And so it not only changes in number, it changes in person, right? It's still third person. He is a singular. It just changes in number. Sorry, I take that story back. It changes in number. So we have they, and then the connector is not a because, but it's an although. Okay, so that's a contrast, not a because of. And that makes sense. It makes sense that Isaiah would be saying this, because here's another dimension of unexpectedness. And if there's anything that's key to chapter 53, it's unexpectedness. Isaiah is like, can you believe this? Nobody sees this coming. This is not what people are anticipating. This is different. And so here again, he makes his grave with the wicked and the rich, although he had done no violence, neither was any deceit in his mouth. So we'll just scan down through here. I think we're going to see consistency in that. They made his grave with the wicked in ESV, although he had done no violence. The NAS, his grave was assigned with wicked men. So there, they don't use either they or he. They just make it an unspecified passive. It was done. And maybe that's how the Hebrew actually is. And to make it clear, the other translators have tried to ascribe a pronoun. Yet he was with rich men in his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. Okay, so here the unexpectedness is not on account of the fact that he had done no violence, but it's expressed as his grave is with wicked men, yet he was with a rich in his death. So a rich man is a positive thing in the ancient world. Okay, so rich men don't get rich by accident. It's because God blesses them. And so you don't connect wickedness and riches typically. And so there's still that element of unexpectedness, but it's placed in a different way.
Well, and criminals who die on a Roman cross don't get buried in a nice tomb.
No, they don't end up with rich men.
Keith, it's interesting to me, because I would associate the grave with the rich man and the death with the wicked, but just the way they're speaking of in death, being where you go, where your body is, and your grave being actually getting to death. Mm-hmm. It's just a different, you know, I wouldn't use those terms that way.
Right. But, you know, looking at the different translations, I think helps you wrap your brain a little bit around the concepts that they're dealing with, whether you know absolutely, if they have them in exactly the right order or not, you still come away with a sense of what this passage means. So a complete Jewish Bible, he was given a grave among the wicked. In his death, he was with a rich man, although he had done no violence and had said nothing deceptive. So that's more in line with ESV and NAS. The NIV, he was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. That's not really a substantial difference from what we've seen there. Okay, but I don't know about you, but I feel like I have a lot better handle on what's being said than I did when I just read the King James. Okay, so that was 9. 10. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Okay, so probably the first thing that I stumbled on here as a young person first being exposed to this passage was the phrase, yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. And, you know, that can form an image of God, which is misleading. It wasn't that God is sadistic or was happy about what was happening. If you look at the word there, which is translated pleased, the Hebrew word, is kafetz. And if you, one of the most helpful ways to get a feel on it instead of just a definition is to look how it's used in other places in the Old Testament. And you quickly realize that it can mean willed. It is your will. And so it's very different in my mind to say God was pleased to see Jesus crucified and to say, as opposed to saying it was his will that that happened. And his will in the sense not that he ordered it, but it was his will that Jesus go the distance, go the whole way. This is the path that's laid out for you. It's actually the transgression of men that is driving this. It's clear from Isaiah that it's man's iniquity that is falling on Jesus, falling on in the sense of to fall on somebody to murder them. And it is God's will that Jesus permit this to happen because he didn't have to. He said as much. He told his disciples in the garden, do you not think if I ask the Father, he would not send me 12 legions of angels? That's significant resources. And so he had the ability to do otherwise. But once again, I think one of the primary motifs we find in this chapter is shock and surprise. And so Isaiah is, again, he's looking at everything that's happening here to this human being who has done no violence. There is no deceit in his mouth. He opens not his mouth against those who accuse him. And yet these things are happening, and it's God's will. There's another level of unexpectedness there, of shock, of wonder. Yet it pleased the Lord. It was his will that this happen.
There's such a different color there, though. If you
even think about it the way that we use language or the way that we live, to allow something to will to not intrude on it.
Yes.
Or, you know, you do that as your children are growing up. It's like, in order for the good to be done, there will be pain in their life.
Uh-huh.
It's not that it pleases you that they're in pain, mm-hmm. but that this, I'm going to step back and let this happen because this is what is the good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's very different than like, oh, I can't wait to see them suffer.
Right.
Messed up.
Yeah. And I think it's important to have those kind of distinct ideas in your mind and make those kind of distinctions when you read this passage so that you don't just open your mouth and swallow the notion, well, yeah, God's that way. No, he's not that way. An interesting wrinkle in my mind as well, this second phrase, he hath put him to grief. And so I think probably I would have naturally just said, okay, that's just talking about, you know, the crucifixion and what's going on here. But the word grief there is a word which relates to sickness or weakness. And so I'm wondering if that's not an expression of, you know, the fact that even though Christ was not weak, even though, in fact, he had the resources of an infinite God at his disposal, he was God in man, yet he suffered this experience which said everything is weak here. This is what this looks like. This is what weakness looks like. This is inability to stand up to one's enemies. This is being totally at their disposal. And so to me, that phrase speaks not so much of his physical abuse, but just the fact that he's even experiencing it at all. It speaks of the fact that God, through Jesus Christ, made himself weak, made himself available to the kind of treatment that he got. And of course, I would add, because of his love for us. Because it's what he wanted to do, because of what he chose to do. It wasn't that he was at his extremities. He wasn't beyond resources, but he placed himself there.
I'm wondering, I'm guessing he was severely dehydrated on the cross. And he felt the physical effects, but he pushed through them, even in talking. In Psalm 22, part of it mentions, and my tongue cleaves to my jaw.
Mm.
I'm guessing he was severely dehydrated, and his tongue may have been dry,
mm-hmm.
hard to speak. I don't know if that's why he didn't finish Psalm 22, or if it was with the idea he gave the first verse so that people who cared,
mm-hmm.
would say, oh, a beautiful psalm about the deliverance of God. I don't know, but it makes me wonder, is that what they're talking about? That he was weak physically?
I mean, just in general, the picture we see of him on the cross is of a human being who is at the mercy of not his own strength, but he's... It's a sign of weakness. Everything is about a weakness there, right? So you're under somebody else's control. You are experiencing all the shortcomings of the flesh, its inability to withstand this kind of treatment. It's just a picture of weakness.
He stumbled under the weight of the cross. Mm-hmm. They had somebody else carry it for him. It's easy to just read the scripture and not really think about the conditions and what he was facing. And for me, when I start thinking about this, is a beautiful picture of pushing through the physical discomforts of life to do what is best and think of others, which is unnatural. That's the grace of God.
One of the interesting things that struck me as I was listening to Nabil Qureshi's book on Seeking out finding Jesus. Thank you. Was that as a Muslim in hearing about the gospel, he was just totally repelled by the notion that God would suffer like this. You know, no, there's no way that would happen to God. And so that helps me even more so wrap my mind around the kind of surprise that Isaiah is expressing in this suffering servant. That is certainly in the culture of the Mideast. No, that doesn't happen to God. That's not possible. It doesn't even make sense.
That's the statement that crucifixion makes in the Roman world. Was like, this is what happens when you go against strength.
Mm-hmm.
So, might is right.
Mm-hmm. So, for a long time, I've realized that first part of that verse needed to be understood in terms of will, but everybody, I guess, needs to see that for the first time. So there's that aspect of verse 10. And then we have, when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Now, if you didn't have the first half of that verse and you only read the second, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Who might you think he was talking about?
Abraham comes among the first men.
Any righteous man, really, right? So those are the kind of blessings that come on those who fear God. Seed, their seed. They have lots of kids. We've been doing Amish taxes this year, this week, and let me tell you, it helps on your taxes. Now, if you have over 20, it makes your tax preparer crazy because you got to type them all in. Actually, probably 15 would do that too, but it does help on your taxes. But anyway, that was one of the things that was a great comfort to the Israelites whenever they had a lot of offspring. You know, my name is going to be continued. My posterity will continue. And so then these kind of things then are ways of expressing the benefits of serving God. Prolong his days. The pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. So what this verse does then, it transitions between this statement that it's God's will for him to suffer in this way, but in the end, he will be in a position which is highly desirable. Okay, so this verse makes that transition. The fulcrum in the middle is, in King James, when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin. Okay? So, in this process of coming to a better understanding of the verse, let's check these other passages, these other translations. JPS says, yet it pleased the Lord to crush him by disease, to see if his soul would offer itself in restitution, that he might see his seed, prolong his days, and that the purpose of the Lord might prosper by his hand. Okay, so we've been looking at these different elements of language that were a part of that verse. Notice the difference in connection that's made here in the first part, to crush by disease. Okay, it pleased the Lord to crush by disease. Well, we hadn't thought of it in those terms, had we? So that'll be something that we watch as we look at these different translations. Does anybody else see it as saying that? Next we have, to see if his soul would offer itself in restitution, as opposed to when thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin. And then, of course, the end of the verse is similar to the King James. Okay, ESV. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. he has put him to grief. So that's back to where we were on those first two elements. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring, he shall prolong his days, so on and so forth. Okay, so still a little unclear in that middle part, but we're beginning to see this connection that there is a suggestion that these positive outcomes are the result of something which occurs in this middle phrase, mm-hmm. Right? When this happens, then this will be the result. Let's see if we can get any more clarity by looking at some more translations. NAS, but the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. He will render himself as a guilt offering. He will see his offspring. He will prolong his days. I'm sorry, if, I forgot that if. That is an important word sometimes. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring. He will prolong his days. Okay, so this particular translation sees a clear connection between this action in the middle and the results, the positive results, but it puts the actor as the one who is getting crushed, if he would, right? We weren't quite so sure in some of the other translations. King James, when thou shalt make his offering for sin, who does the thou refer to? ESV, when his soul makes an offering, so it's him doing it, just expressed in a little different way. So, complete Jewish Bible, and it pleased Adonai to crush him with illness. Okay, so now we're back to the same thing as the Jewish Publication Society. And apparently, if you're Hebrew, that tends to be the connection you see in that that first phrase. So it pleased the Lord to see if he would present himself as a guilt offering. Okay, so that advances a very definite notion about motive here. This is why he did it. And there is the question mark, will he do it? So an interesting understanding. If he does, he will see his offspring. He will prolong his days, and accordingly. NIV, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life an offering for sin, he will see his offspring, prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. So they take away the he doing the making his life an offering and make it the Lord. So, you know, we've looked at a number of translations, and really there are some very, very different ideas here. As if you're going to form your theology on this, there are some very different ideas presented. Now, it is well known that your theology has an effect on your translation, right? If you have a network for understanding how things fit together and something is not quite clear, you go with what makes sense in your worldview. And that's not a criticism, that's just a fact, right? That's how you have to do it. That's how we talk. That's how language works. And so sometimes translations are more commentary on the theology of the translators than they are on the intention of the writer they're translating. And here I would say we have to appeal to the New Testament and the understanding of men that we believe were inspired by God, and certainly in direct communication with Jesus himself. We have to rely on their take on all this to settle some of these issues. So this could take a while, right? But I do want to at least bring to your mind one passage that we have read in the not too distant past. Sorry, where'd that future come from? It came because my mind was on what I was doing with the cursor. That's where it came from. that offers an understanding of this. This is in my way. Thank you. So, in the book of Hebrews, we have expressed an understanding of what Jesus has done. That I think should have an impact on our understanding of what he did. And I think I have the verse I want here. Here we are. So in Hebrew chapter 9, and you can read more of it later to get the bigger sense of context. But the Hebrew writer says, "How much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God?" So I think we can recognize that even though in Hebrews Christ is pictured as the high priest, therefore a mediator, as the lamb, as that which is sacrificed, and those two are not identical roles normally. He pictures him both ways. The predominant sense in which the Hebrew writer pictures him is that of our high priest. We have, therefore, a high priest who, as he speaks, offers his own blood to God on our behalf. And so I'm hearing echoes of Isaiah 53 in this verse, and thinking that the Hebrew writer understood the verse we're looking at in the sense of Christ offering himself, offering his own blood, as opposed to somebody else offering it, as opposed to even God offering it. And so that in my mind is a heavy influence on understanding that this passage in verse 10.
I have a question.
Yes.
I don't know if we can even have an answer to, but the seed part, would that be like we are the seed of Christ, or the churches, or is it just more a general like prospering?
Well, I mean, I think that there certainly is the promise of he will be the firstborn among many brethren. Now, okay, if he's a brother, he's not the father. And yet, in the sense of those kind of roles and relationships, we are all children of the Father, even though Jesus is God as well. And so I don't think we should probably quibble about that. We can be his brothers, and yet the seed, the ones carrying on the heart of what his life was, through many generations. I think he's speaking of there's going to be a lot of people like him because of what he did.
It makes me think of when Jesus said, who is my mother, who are my brothers? It's those who do the will of the Father. So it's like this is a family connection. Imagine some people would take this and say Jesus was married or had physical
children. Sure.
Whatever, and it's like, well, I think God's idea of how seed and family and all that works is a little bit different than ours.
And if you can be either a mother or a brother in doing his will, it seems like we're losing those kind of physical dimensions that we want to associate with those names. It is about a family tie.
It seems that he alluded to this in John chapter 17. In the prayer of keeping
the unity aspect.
Yes, and then the idea of While I was with them, I was keeping them in your name, which you had given them. And I guarded them, and not one of them perished with the son of perdition, so that Scripture would be fulfilled.
So in your name.
I'm sorry.
In your name is, yeah. Yes, so there's the family likeness, there's the family name, there's the connection. Yeah. But, so then with looking at this verse, Isaiah foresees that, yes, it is the will of Adonai that he experienced this in weakness. And yet, if he offers himself in this way, then the results will be, as it's put sometimes in the New Testament, that God has exalted him above all. In the Old Testament, the typical way of expressing that is, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days. The good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand.
Keith,
I don't want to start a two-hour discussion.
Oh, try.
I totally understand and agree with the fact that there's a direct, in Scripture, there doesn't seem to be a direct substitutionary atonement.
Yes.
Jesus directly takes all of our punishment and that kind of thing. But there's definitely a level at which, I think it's pretty clear in this passage and other places, and even Hebrews, that Jesus is offering himself for our sin.
Yes.
So I'd like you to, if you could maybe quickly or later at length kind of discuss, in what way does he do that? If it's not a direct,
yes,
one-to-one, the traditional way you tend to,
yes,
then how does he do that? How does that kind of function?
So absolutely, I am saying that Jesus died for us. There's no problem with that language. The problem is the theology that sometimes is behind it, what that means. So, yes, I have 3 minutes. No, well, that's good. And actually, I mean, that's kind of where we're going with this. I wanted to get through the verses so we could not stumble over some of the phraseology and get a feel for what actually is being said. But if you will allow me, I will defer on that because I do want to do it justice. And that is the big question. So if we say that some of these other ideas are incorrect, well, what is correct? What are we saying? And how do we understand the fact that it was for us? Because it clearly is. If you believe in sola scriptura, that's what it says. It was for us. But in what sense? And how should we then live? Right. So will you allow me to defer on that? Maybe we can get to that a little better next Sunday. But that's definitely where we're headed. And I will quite frankly tell you, I'm not offering this as the ultimate dispenser of truth. I'm trying to understand the truth, and I think we are together. And so this path through Isaiah has contributed greatly to making connections for me between other scriptures and seeing how this fits together. And so, yes, the following Christ is a matter of growing and understanding, and as well as other things. But we pursue the truth that he has given us. And certainly this chapter is amazing on every level and brings into focus a number of issues that were important. Okay, I'm fresh out of time. And Pastor has been studying for 3 weeks for this sermon. And I don't know that if that means his notes are shorter or longer or have more arrows or what, but we will soon find out. Stay tuned. Thank you. Thank you.
be a witness that you are God. But the more I know you, the less I know what to say. Who you are is more than I can fathom. There's nothing to compare. Who you are, Lord, how can I declare that you as my patient redeemer. Just one.